Can I ask you something? What's your family story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded.
We are back with Vid History Makers with my co-host, Kevin. Today we are exploring, very similar to the last few episodes, somebody that I haven't heard of at all, ever. And I look into these figures and I feel so blessed to be able to go along this journey with you. I pray that it never stops. I begin to understand the people, the notable people that have shaped the country.
Thank you, Ken. And you know, you make me want to say something, which is that as I was doing some research on the person who we're going to discuss today, I felt almost a sense of this kind of sadness, but also happiness. Sadness in that we're really just scratching the surface. Really just scratching the surface. Like there's so much we don't know that I don't know, but so much that's so interesting. So these episodes are really meant just to introduce people to these figures and hopefully inspire them to learn more about these figures, to read more about them, and to read their writing. So it's kind of sad on the one hand that there's only so much we can talk about, but it's also great that we are. So,
yeah. And I just want to remind the audience one more time that you spend a lot of time working on these episodes to bring life to these figures. So we can introduce and invite the audience to donate on our YouTube page.
Yeah, thank you very much. So listeners, if you find these helpful, entertaining, if you feel like you've learned from them, we appreciate donations. I work on these typically at a cafe. You could buy me a coffee by buying a super thanks on YouTube, and seeing those super thanks make me really happy and motivate me to keep going. So thanks for your support.
We'll get right into it. Recently, I went to hear Ocean Vuong speak at a big event. There's like 800 people at this downtown theater, and it was amazing. It was absolutely wonderful to hear him. And what I began to realize is that so many thinkers in our diaspora that I know about, and now I'm beginning to see this pattern a lot, are poets. People who are intellectuals, who are writers and journalists and novelists and Pulitzer winners, and you know, a lot of these people come from poetry backgrounds, and it's really interesting to know this. And as I'm listening to Ocean talk, I can understand the structural side of how poetry is put together, and it makes you really think about the economy of words as you're putting lines together. And as you're doing this exercise of words, you're thinking about how society is organized. And I think the figure today is somebody who probably came up in that sort of way of thinking.
Yeah. You know, I never really gave that much thought, but you're totally right. So many of these great writers are poets. And so the poet we're looking at today, he wasn't just a poet. He was a major intellectual, cultural figure in the first half of the 20th century. His name is Phan Khoi. Hugely influential journalist, poet, translator. Again, we're really just scratching the surface here. I mean, he is so famous for different things, but he's really famous for his writings about reforming the Vietnamese language. And he's famous for his journalism, his critiques of Vietnamese society, and his involvement also in the Nhân Văn Giải Phóng movement, which we've talked about. And it's interesting, due to historical reasons, and I think this might be why you really haven't heard of him, Ken, is because it wasn't until 1991 that Thanh Khoi was officially mentioned in Vietnam in this dictionary of Vietnamese historical figures published by the official publishing house, the Social Sciences Publishing House. And there's a reason for why he was kind of hidden from history, and it's likely because of his involvement in this sort of free speech movement, the Nhân Văn Giải Phóng movement. But there is one scholar in Vietnam, his name is Lai Nguyen An, and he's one of these rare scholars in Vietnam who has devoted his whole life to studying Thanh Khoi. He's published many books in Vietnamese on Thanh Khoi. When I was in Vietnam, I picked up one of his books. So there's also somebody who devotes their life to studying Phan Boi Cho and another person to Phan Chu Trinh. But Phan Khoi is one of these titanic figures. And I think if listeners don't know who he is, and listeners probably don't know, I think this is a nice description of him by Christopher Gosha, who's seen as probably one of the most influential, important historians of Vietnam, writing in English, Christopher Gosha. He calls Thanh Khoi one of the staunchest defenders of human liberty in Vietnam.
So he probably was not liked by the Viet Minh at the time, or the Communist Party, the early Communist Party, and probably the history as the country was developing in the 70s and 80s, we have to bury this guy.
Maybe. I'm not going to answer that question, but perhaps it's more complicated. But I think there's some truth in what you're saying there. Yeah, I mean, he was a defender of human liberty. So that's what this episode's going to be about. What does that mean to call him a defender of human liberty?
And why do you say human liberty and not human rights? Is there a distinction between... No, I really, the wordplay here is important, I think, because when I think about somebody defending human liberty, I'm like thinking, why don't you just call it human rights? No, you, Kevin, why don't you call it? Or is it just in the literature, human liberty is a human liberty, or is it human rights at the time? Or is it morphed into something that became human rights later that we know comes from human liberty?
This is a really good question. Let's take a really quick detour here into the word liberty and rights. So what does a right mean? Typically, when we talk about human rights, we are talking about something that you cannot violate. We are all entitled to the right to free speech, for example, or the right a right to movement, right? Or a right to physical integrity. You cannot just punch me. But the question is, who protects these rights? It's always a state. You need a powerful, strong state to protect your rights. And so when I say I have a right, that means that nobody can violate that right. And if they try to, the state will protect me. If you have no state, you have no rights, right? Because who's going to protect you, right? You need a powerful state. One justification for rights is human dignity. This idea that we all have this precious inner worth, this dignity, and that's why we have rights. But there are philosophers who say that rights are coextensive with power. So you need power to have rights. That's why I'm talking about the state. You have exactly as much right as you have power. So let's say I say I have a right to free speech, but if I don't have a pen and pencil, or if I don't have a microphone, or if I don't have a way to publish, do I really have that right? You know, so it is coextensive with how much power I have. That's why even in Vietnamese, the word for rights and power have the same root. Quyền lực, right? Power. Power and rights are the same. The philosopher Spinoza even said that. Let's turn to the word liberty. This is really interesting. This is my research right now, the meaning of freedom or liberty. So there is a philosopher named Isaiah Berlin who famously says there's two kinds of freedom, negative freedom and positive freedom. Negative. Well, let me ask you, Ken, since you're the student, what does freedom mean?
Wow, what a crazy question. What does freedom mean? I mean, isn't it obvious to most of us? Freedom means just the ability to do what you want to do without, I think there's an implication in my mind, without harming society or other people. You should be able to say and do whatever you want without harming other people. That's freedom. I think the minute you start to encroach in other people's, you know, area, space, then it becomes something different. But for the most part, for me, being able to say, think, you know, act in my own space without touching or, you know, getting other people affected is freedom.
That's great. This is the prevailing conception of freedom in the West. And this comes from many different philosophers in the Western tradition. But Thomas Hobbes, for example, exactly says that freedom is simply the absence of obstacles. You want to do something, you have freedom if there are no obstacles in between you and the thing you want to do, right? And then you also evoked another philosopher, John Stuart Mill, who comes up with the harm principle, which is that we should all be free until it harms someone else. So I am free to swing my fists around until it hits your face, right?
Yeah.
I must stop at your face. So you evoked these very famous ways of understanding freedom. So this is what Isaiah Berlin calls negative freedom. It's freedom from interference. So in the West, we tend to think that we have freedom if there's a small government or even no government. That's why there are anarchists or libertarians who say, I care about freedom. And what they mean is when there's no government interfering with them, stopping them, taxing them. You know, that's a kind of interference. But that's one conception of freedom. There's also positive freedom. What that means is that, let's say I have no obstacles in front of me to become a professor. But at the same time, let's say that I have no money and I have very little food and I'm hungry all the time and I have to worry about rent and I might not have a roof over my head. Am I really free to become a professor? There are no obstacles in front of me. Physically, like no one's stopping me, but am I really free, Ken?
No, you are not. And I think that there are these invisible measures and metrics that block society from creating paths that humans want to take, such as being a doctor or a professor. And
To become a doctor or a professor, I need an education. To have an education, I need a certain environment. I need money. I need food in my belly so that I can think. I need clothes. I need to be free from fear. So therefore, some people who believe in positive freedom, they say, actually, we need government to come in and create welfare for us. We need healthcare. We need universal access to education, to housing. For example, we need to tax people so that we can have these things. And the libertarians might argue back and say, no, that's imposing on my freedom. But the other positive freedom people will argue, no, this will enhance the freedom of everybody. Because positive freedom is freedom to, not freedom from interference, but it's freedom to become your own master. That's what positive freedom is. It's freedom to become your own master. And so, yeah, I don't want to be a slave to other people. I want to be a slave to myself. That's what freedom is.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand, through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall Credit Card Bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.
You know, when I hear you break down these ideas, and I think about Funcoy from 1887 to 1959, I think about the idea that what we're talking about is in the ether already, in the world. It's like these principles were probably floating around years before he even got to understanding, Funcoy got to understanding the universe of human liberty in Vietnam. Is yeah. that true? Is it already existing and floating around in books in the library in Vietnam in the 1800s or late 1800s?
Absolutely, absolutely. So the first version of freedom that we were talking about, this negative freedom, that is what scholars and philosophers would look back today and they would say that's a kind of liberalism. That's the meaning of generally what liberalism is. Liberalism emphasizes individual freedom, and it's a negative freedom. It's freedom from imposition. And this comes from a tradition of philosophers fighting against tyrannical governments and autocratic monarchs. So back in the past, you know, when you had monarchs in Europe, they would impose their will. And so you had philosophers saying, no, we have human rights. You need to leave us alone. And so that is a kind of freedom. However, with the emergence of capitalism, because one ideology that supports capitalism is liberalism. It's individual freedom. Give me the freedom to do what I want in the marketplace. I should be free to buy and sell whatever I want. I'm an individual. Leave me alone. Okay, this is capitalism, so everybody's free to buy and sell. But of course, that generated massive inequalities, exploitation, suffering. So you had theorists such as Karl Marx argue against this. But they also care about freedom, but they're going to see freedom in a different way. And they're going to promote that version of positive freedom that I was talking about. Now, can I ask you, can you see any possible problems with this positive freedom, this idea that freedom is really, you know, you need things to become your own master? Do you see any problems with that?
The first thing that comes to mind is, well, if you need to have somebody carve out special sort of privileges or abilities for you to become a doctor or professor, the state has to jump in and control these things. And I think that when you have the state instituting these programs, then I think that could be a problem, because it's a sort of an artificial thing that has to be created and enforced by the state. And that, I think that is sort of the problem.
Exactly. Yeah. Let's think of drug addiction, right? An addict is not free. They are a slave to drugs or alcohol or whatever. But let's say you have the state jump in and say, all right, we'll help you be free. We'll take this stuff away from you. Do you think that's good? Would that state then enable freedom if they took away these drugs?
Yes, I think that there's societies that prove that that works.
But Ken, somebody would argue against you and be like, that's so problematic. That's the state treating us as if we're children. It's the state deciding what's good for us and then forcing that upon us. Therefore, in the name of freedom, the state is actually oppressing us. So that's an argument against positive freedom, that when the state pretends to be wiser, more paternalistic, that's really dangerous, because it's a slippery slope to the state saying, okay, well, then drugs and alcohol are bad for you. Then reading this or this idea is bad for
you. Yeah. Where's the line? Does it end?
Exactly. Yeah. So this is all to say it's a debate, right? Is freedom the positive version or the negative version? These Vietnamese thinkers are very much aware of these tensions. So let's continue with Funcoy here. Okay. So one important thing that I should say about Funcoy is that he was really influenced by a Chinese writer named Lu Sun. Have you heard of Lu Sun?
Never.
L-U-X-U-N. He was one of China's greatest writers of the 20th century. And so I did not know much about Lu Sun as well, but if you look at, you know, if you were interested in who were the great writers in China in the early 20th century, he is one of the greatest figures. So it's important to say a little bit about Lu Sun, and that way I think we can better understand Fan Koi. Again, back, by the way, such influence from China, right? That's one theme throughout all these episodes. I mean, China is really influential here.
You know, I am starting the conversation with John Pham over at Columbia in linguistics. And, you know, we're trying to do what we do here at Vid History Makers, but for linguistics. And this equation of China is, it's like the 800-pound gorilla in the room.
Yeah.
It's there.
Yeah, because we have to keep in mind that in the early 20th century, all these older scholars in Vietnam, they were writing in classical Chinese or Zhu Nong, right? These are Chinese characters. Quốc ngữ, the Latinized version of the Vietnamese language, will not become popular until the 1930s, really. And that is even when they were trying to develop it. We'll talk more about that. Basically, Lu Sun was influenced by social Darwinism, this idea that the strong will devour the weak. And if you want to survive as a people, you must become strong and you must embrace what's new. And it's only the new that will make you strong. And it's probably the old that makes you weak. Like when Britain and France were encroaching into Asia in the late 1900s, many Confucians were saying, why is this happening? Is it because we've been dabbling in this Confucian nonsense, talk about morality and all that stuff? Meanwhile, the West is learning science and technology and, you know, ways of reorganizing their societies, democracy. That's why they're so strong. So from that perspective, back then, the obvious answer was, let's reevaluate Confucianism. And so Lu Sun travels to Japan in 1902, and he learns from Japanese modernization, and he starts to condemn traditional Confucian culture in China in his writings. Lu Sun is also translating Marxist theory, so he's a key figure in the May 4th movement. The May 4th movement is a very significant event in Chinese history. So this was in 1919. And really quick for listeners, in 1919, so it's the end of World War I, and in 1919, the great powers who emerge victorious from World War I, they meet in France in Versailles to do the Versailles Treaty, to come up with how are we going to create this new world order after World War I. Well, the Chinese were very upset that at the Versailles conference, the Versailles Treaty awarded these German-controlled territories in China to Japan. They gave them to Japan rather than giving them back to China. So Chinese people were very humiliated. They were very angry at this decision. And so this sparked a student movement against this perceived Chinese weakness, you know. But it became much more than that. It became a movement for new ideas, democracy, science, nationalism, rejection of Confucianism. It became a movement to learn about Marxism. Basically, you need to imagine a lot of really angry Chinese people at the Versailles Treaty. So Lu Sun is participating in that, and he's writing about all this. He's criticizing traditional Chinese society, and Fan Koi is really inspired by Lu Sun. So Fan Koi is reading a lot of Lu Sun. So that, I think that's a good context. Yeah. All right. So let's do a brief bio of Fan Koi. All right. So Fan Koi was born in 1887. So he's a little younger than Fan Chuqin, who was born
1900?
Fan Chuqin was born in 1872, I think. Yeah, 1872. And Ho Chi Minh was born in 1890. So Phan Khoi is born in between them. So he began studying Chinese characters at age 5. By the time he's 9 years old, he gets sent to study with a really famous but progressive Confucian scholar. So the point here is that he was really immersed in Chinese writings and Confucianism. By the time he's 19, he earns his, what we would call a bachelor's degree in exams in Hui. And at this point, he was also really interested in learning Quốc ngữ, so Latinized Vietnamese and French. So he's studying French and Quốc ngữ. And while studying French, he works as a teacher of Chinese characters at a school. So he's teaching also Quốc ngữ and Chinese characters. So he's learning these languages. And by 1906, Phan Chu Chin, who we've talked about, came back from Japan and inspired Phan Khoi to famously cut off his hair. And this is really important because the hairstyle back then was to keep it like long in this kind of traditional Chinese way. But the new thing to do was to cut off the long hair and make your hair short. This was really famous and really powerful. It was a symbolic act in 1906, 1907 at the Dongqing Nietok. There were even songs and poems about this. Phan Khoi made a poem and it became a song that went something like, a comb in your left hand and scissors in your right, and we are modernizing, we are civilizing, you know, and we're going to stand up to the French. And so these young people would cut off their hair as a way of showing their being modern, you know. And this also is symbolic of this rejection of this old Confucian tradition. Anyway, so 1908, Phan Khoi travels to Nam Dinh, which, by the way, is my Quê. He travels to Nam Dinh to study French. And soon after, he's arrested for his participation in nationalist activities. He's imprisoned in Guangnam until 1911. So after he's released from prison, he goes to Hue. And by this time, he's in his mid-20s, and he enrolls in school to continue studying French. In 1915, he begins teaching Chinese characters and Quốc ngữ in a classroom in his own home. And then in 1916, the examination system is abolished in the north of Vietnam, Tonkin. And at this point, this is interesting. Phan Khoi tells his students want to learn Chinese characters, but he actually tells them, look, what's the point of learning Chinese characters? You know, what's the point? The future is Quốc ngữ and French. You should be learning those languages instead of Chinese characters. So then he moves to Hanoi in 1918. And this is interesting. He gets introduced to Pham Quyen, who we've talked about in this series. And so Pham Quyen has this journal that he's editor of, Nam Phong. And Phan Khoi starts writing for Nam Phong, starts working for the journal as a staff member. And then he resigns after 2 years. He gets into a fight with Pham Quyen, which I don't really know why. I should try to figure that out, but some scholars say that, but they don't really say why. Anyway, he resigns from Pham Quyen's journal. He writes for a few other newspapers and periodicals. He was also the first to translate the Bible from Chinese and French to Vietnamese. Interesting.
Totally interesting. Wow.
Yeah. So he is under surveillance, however, by colonial authorities because of his nationalist involvement. And he continues to write for journals in the 1920s. In 1929, Phan Khoi moves to Saigon, and he writes for this newspaper called Phụ Nữ Tân Văn, so Women's News, which is a journal about gender issues, but interestingly, a lot of Vietnamese men would write in it, and some of them would even pretend to be women, like their names. That's interesting. So here he is writing, publishing his writings about language. And so we're going to talk more about that. But another thing that's really important to say here is that in the second issue of Phụ Nữ, Tân Văn, in 1932, he publishes this short essay or it's kind of a poem, but I see this pop up when you read Vietnamese history in different history books. So it's a famous one, but it's called Dinh Ya, Old Love. And this poem is seen today as the poem that started this whole movement called the New Poetry Movement. This is significant. So basically what the movement was is that it's breaking from tradition, and it's starting new ways of thinking about how to relate to people in society. So for example, it started the use of doi, like calling yourself doi. You know, in the Vietnamese language, it's very relational. When I go to Vietnam, I need to figure out where I am in the hierarchy. If I meet a young person, I'll call them am, you know, or an older person, an, and it can get awkward. Like one time I met a young woman when I lived in Vietnam, when I was, I was 23, and I met a young woman and I called her G, and she was really upset because she was like, how dare you? You know, I'm. Anyway, the new poetry movement, they wanted to free up expression of for the individual from this, what they saw as oppressive family hierarchies and social relations. And so they promoted this idea of being an individual. And his poem, Old Love, I'm just going to read part of the poem to you and ask you what you get from it. Okay, so some context. He is describing a meeting, a chance meeting of two lovers, long after they decided to part ways to accept their arranged marriages. So they had fallen in love when they were younger, but their parents made them marry other people. And then years later, they run into each other. So this is the poem. He says, 24 years later, a chance encounter far away, both heads had turned to silver. Had they not known each other well, might they not have passed unknown? An old affair was recalled, no more. It was just a glance in passing. I mean, what do you make of that poem?
Wow. I'm thinking of what possibly could have gone before it. What notions of order, what notions of human connection and love comes before that thought of, you know, it probably existed and nobody actually wrote about it. And that's sort of like, I think, in my mind, because if everything was arranged marriages, you know, who would dare to speak out about the glance of an old lover or somebody you really, you know, was in love with when you were a kid? You know, that all of that swept under the rug, and let's not talk about it. We will perform what is expected of us in this society of arranged marriages.
Yeah. So these poets, this new movement, they were talking about true love was a way of saying, look, this is new and it's against the traditional and the old. True love, going like loving people who, you know, thinking for yourself, essentially, that's modern, right? So he's going to be praised for this. It's also quite iconoclastic, you know, going against the tradition, expectations of the parents and the family and so on. So later, however, he is going to be criticized by some Marxists for being too much of an idealist. So Marxists are dialectical materialists, and they are going to focus on the economic relations, and they're going to criticize Phan Khoi for thinking too much in terms of ideas change the world. That's a very Hegelian and non-Marxist way of thinking about historical change. So after the August Revolution of 1945, Phan Khoi is invited to join the anti-French resistance, and he moves to the communist guerrilla zone in Viet Bac to participate. And he's actually part of this in the north, and he's going to become one of the major figures in the Nhân Văn Giải Phóng movement. Now, he never identifies as a communist, and if you read accounts by historians, some of them will actually call him an anti-communist. But if you read his writings, you don't see that. So this is actually puzzling to me, because if I read some writers like Huang Wenqi, he's going to say, Fankoy was an anti-communist. But if you actually read Fankoy's writings, he's praising communism. Now, we'll talk more about that in a bit. But, okay, so he participates in the Nianwen Zaifeng, and then he gets into trouble with the authorities, and he gets under house arrest, and he dies in 1959. So remember that the Nianwen Zaifeng movement was a free speech movement between 1956 and 1959. So he dies at the end of that. So that's the brief bio.
Well, and 1959 wasn't that far away. You know, 1959 to 1975, I mean, it's like almost like a modern figure, but born in 1887, which is, you know, pretty mind-blowing if you think about it.
Yeah. So, all right, I want to talk about three things right now, and they all have to do with freedom. So I want to talk about Fankoy and what he says about language and how he's trying to promote freedom through changing the Vietnamese language. And then I want to talk about what he says about speaking freely, so free speech. And then I want to end by talking about book banning, because he has an interesting essay about that. So, okay, let's turn to language. For listeners, if you're of the scholarly type and you're interested in reading some academic stuff, there's a great article by Jack Sibnall, recently published in the Journal of Vietnamese Studies. It's called The Inconvenience of Tradition, Fankoy's Pragmatism and His Proposals for Modernizing Language Reform. So the basic argument that Jack Sibnall makes is that Fankoy is so important because he wanted to reform the Vietnamese language to increase communication in public so that people can debate with each other in public. Now, if you think about it in Vietnamese language, this is really tricky, right? Because if you're always calling somebody chú or ông or am, there's all this like relational stuff that you gotta be mindful of, and it kind of gets in the way of like just directly making arguments.
Honorifics. Right? That's what held us back. Yeah. Right? It's honorifics, the titling.
Yeah, and so Fankoy thought that a lot of this was happening in face-to-face contexts, but how do we modernize language to get out of the face-to-face context so that you could have debates in newspapers, for example, or like a forum, a public forum? And so basically, to have public reason and to get people to exercise their reason and rationality, you should start using doi, I, you know, use the word I instead of referring to yourself in relation to other people. So that's one way that he tried to reform the language. And that's interesting because he knew that language would modernize Vietnamese society if Vietnamese people could start debating with each other using logic and reasoning and arguments, then that would modernize.
Pretty mind blowing to think about that. Because as a modern Vietnamese person, I always thought that. I always like, oh, we're hampered in communication because of the lack of linguistic technology inside of our culture. That's what creates this lack of harmony between the generations living in America and our parents. It's this inability to really, we can't thrust conversation forward because not only are we're hindered by our language skills, but we're also hindered by this honorifics, this respect, this way of talking that we can never tell them how we really feel. And even, really? Yeah, and I mean, I grew up feeling that way, but my parents were relatively open and liberal and encouraged us to speak, but I would see it in other families and it would be so uncomfortable, but I never was able to put my finger on it until now. Like, you know, the conversations that we have make me realize that before Fankoy now, this was not even a thing. I mean, how could you say I to any grown-up or anybody without putting a relational sort of, you know, you're triangulating your position.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Yeah, yeah. It really changes how you think, yeah. too. It's like when I speak English or immediately in Vietnam, I need to think about my relationship and what kind of respect I need to show to someone and so on. Yeah.
It's almost like you have to insert a different type of like, like if you're not playing chess anymore, you're playing, we don't know, in Vietnamese language, you are playing chess because everything's positional. But I think in like English, you take a lot of rules out of the game and you're just able to really just put your opinions and your thoughts and observations out there freely without worrying about how you're going to get responded back to.
So there's that word you said, freely, right? That's exactly what he's concerned with. How do we speak freely so that we can liberate reason? And this is really what we might call a modernist project, an enlightenment project. The whole European enlightenment was what Immanuel Kant famously said. It's when humans step out of their immaturity and have the courage to think for themselves, to not be restrained and held back from custom and tradition and all this older stuff, to really think boldly. So that's the European enlightenment. And this is what Chinese thinkers and Vietnamese thinkers were saying to themselves, maybe we need that.
You know what's really sad, Kevin? I'm witnessing families in my family, my extended family. I'm witnessing just the breakdown of father to son, mother to daughter relationships as we are continuing to live in America. And father doesn't agree with son because, you know, whatever. And it's really just heartbreaking to think that the ability to actually communicate in a free way is not existent. It's impossible for the child to really have a real conversation with the parents because, you know, of this paradigm that we have. And it's nobody's fault when I think about it. You know, I think the Vietnamese language and the structure is beautiful if you're living in Vietnam, if you're living 20, 30 years ago in society in Vietnam. It's a beautiful thing because, you know, it's kind of like that flow. But as soon as you hit foreign shores and you're trying to like, as a parent, you're trying to change a little bit, you're trying to open up, but you're living in the words of your current culture. You cannot evolve quick enough with the children if you're not understanding that there's this force of, you know, the enlightenment behind generations of these Westerners that your kids are now have now become.
Yeah, there seems to be a real tension, right, between this enlightenment approach into thinking for yourself, being an individual, versus the filial piety and the respect. But at the same time, Ken, don't you think that it's possible to go too far in the enlightenment
1,000%.
Direction? And that's really bad as well?
Yes, I do. I think it can be very, very bad. And I can't believe I'm saying that, but in my heart, because then the beauty of our culture, the respect and the nourishment, the warmth that comes from certain unspoken adages, is unable to pop up. So how do you make sense of all of this as first, second, third generation Vietnamese living in the diaspora? And then now, you know, you have a lot of families that are coming from Vietnam who are young families that are not inhibit it with the ideas and the narratives of the war. And now they're going to be dealing with some other weird paradigm shift because of language.
Yeah. Much to think about here. So let's move on now to what Fankoy says about free speech and speaking freely. So I want to quote here from a text that he wrote in 1956. This is 56, 57. This is during the Nyan Van Zaifa movement. And I'm just going to quote him here, and I want to ask what you think about this. So he says, "I want to tell the truth, but some people say that there are truths that should not be told. I don't buy it. I don't believe it. That is under some other regime. But under our regime, which uses criticism and self-criticism as weapons, what truth is there that should not be told?" So he says, I'm going to continue. He says, "I want to criticize, but some people say that internal criticism is fine, but it should not be written in books and newspapers, because when the enemy sees it, they will distort it. I don't believe it either. The period of closed doors to teach each other is over. Today is the day when any internal conflict needs to be resolved in front of the masses. Without the light of the masses to guide us, it cannot be resolved. Moreover, having acknowledged that we eat from the labor of the people, and we work for the people, and the people are the masters, and the people have the right to inspect everything we do, why should we keep it a secret from each other? Why should we not let the people know?" I'll stop there. What is he saying?
You know, I think that the East and the West deals with this, you know, control of information, transparency, showing the different thoughts within the internal structures of government or family. Does that make you weaker, or does it make you seem stronger because you're able to debate this all out, right? And I think that when I think about the Northern culture, it's much more closed. It's much more, you know, on the spectrum of openness and closeness. I think even to this day, my mom is always like, "No, let's not talk about it openly. Let's keep this within our family. Let's not share this out. Let's, you know, be very protective of this information." I see this a lot.
Some context here, though. So in the north of Vietnam in 1956-57, remember, they kick out the French in 54. And now at this point, there's the Second Indochina War, right? Between North Vietnam and South Vietnam, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam in the north, which is led by communists. That is where Fankoy is. And he's telling that government in these writings, he's saying, like, "Look, I'm with you. I agree with our regime. Our regime is good. Our regime has the truth. And we all know that we make mistakes, and we need to rectify those mistakes. And the best way to do that is to discuss those mistakes in front of the people. I understand that you're afraid that if we write about our mistakes, the capitalist enemies in the South will take advantage of it and use it against us, but we shouldn't be afraid of that." Right? So that's basically what he's saying here. It's also like what Malcolm X would say. It's like, if you're in a movement and you have disagreements, you should get in a huddle. Don't let your enemies know, because they're going to exploit the mistakes and divide you. So anyway, I think it's interesting here that he's, you know, I was about to say he's pretending, but who knows if he's pretending or not, right? Maybe he really does think that the regime is good. Some people will say, "Oh, he's just pretending to praise the regime."
Well, I think you can be both. You can believe in the party and the regime and your team's vision, but you can also critique it and saying, "Hey, although I do side with how we see things, but there are also other ways to identify progress within our own ecosystem."
Yeah. And I think, okay, what he does here, I'm going to read another quote, but what he does, I think, is really clever, because he's going to say, look, our minds are, they still have residues from the old bad regimes, the feudal regimes, the colonial regimes. And so we actually need to purify ourselves. So he's actually using this language of Marxism purification. So he says, quote, what do we do now? Granted, our regime is good, but who are we? We are people who have lived under feudal, colonial, and imperialist regimes, more or less. The evil thoughts of those evil regimes still linger in our minds, more or less. And this gives rise to evil phenomena that we can only see if we close our eyes. So it's in our minds. Now we must have the courage to look straight at those dark phenomena, expose them, and demand that we correct them. Correct them to the very root of our thoughts. Only then will our regime become better and more sustainable. Only then will we be worthy of Marxists, of being Marxists, communists, and citizens of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. Isn't that interesting? Like he's saying, like, we should be Marxists and communists, but we can only be worthy of that when we expose our bad thinking.
That's so anti. When I think about the closed government of Vietnam, I think of, you know, the inability to critique anything in the government. For the most part, from the public, from the masses.
Yeah. You would have to watch the debates they have in their assembly.
Are those open for us to watch?
Oh, yeah. You can watch it on YouTube.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. You listeners, you can watch National Assembly debates on YouTube, and they are criticizing each other all the time.
They get down like that.
Oh, yeah.
See, and that's the weird thing that we don't know. Why don't we know about that, right? Right.
So there is a, I'll do a shout out here. There is a very popular YouTuber named Luna Ai. She's a self-proclaimed communist. She's a young Vietnamese woman in Vietnam. And she has been criticized for being a tanky.
Wait, a tanky?
Do you know what a tanky is? So tankies are people who are very pro-communists, and they're called tankies because there were communists in Eastern Europe and in China. And you remember the tanks crushing Tiananmen? Those kids in Tiananmen Square. People in defense of those tanks, right? Yeah. So Stalinists or really staunch, intolerant communists, anyway, I don't know how fair it is to call her that. Maybe she would embrace it. Who knows? But that is a slur for communists. But anyway, she has translated some National Assembly debates. And so you could just watch them on YouTube, just YouTube Luna Ai. Anyway, I think she has some interesting perspectives. And her perspectives are among other perspectives. So anyway. Okay.
When I think about the current landscape of the Vietnamese government or any government modern, it's so huge to me. It's so big to me. But then when you think about Phan Khoi and you're just quoting his thoughts, it seems like a thinker that covers such a lot of ground, right? But he's just one guy in this period, and how much voice does he really have? Because if you and I were guys that were Phan Khoi, we have this opinion and we have this thought, we're starting to write a lot, critiquing the government today. We're like a drop. We're like a piece of a sand pebble in this ocean of government. But guys like Phan Khoi, are they insignificant, or are they really bigger than, they're thinkers that have do they have big ripples, like somebody like Phan Khoi in the government of his time?
Ken, the answer is that he was arrested he got in trouble with the party for saying exactly these things. And he's under house arrest, and he dies under house arrest. And then the party bans his writings for the next 40 years. I think that's enough to show us that he was very influential. I mean, he was a big writer in those journals that I mentioned, Nanfeng, the Women's News, and very prolific writer, wrote thousands of essays. So yeah, he was really influential, and that's precisely why the government arrested him and like banned his work. So,
you know,
one thing that
it feels like, if we were to break down a percentage of all the people that we've covered in these figures, in Vid History Makers, almost everybody went to jail at some point. Almost everybody was in
prison. Yeah, either by the French colonial government or the communist government.
Like you cannot have street cred if you didn't do time. It's just, there's no way to.
Yeah,
you don't make it on the map if you didn't do a few years in jail.
Yeah. One thing I wonder, though, in the quotes that I just read to you, I also wonder if he's just pretending to defend the regime. And is there a kind of inner censor in him? You know, who knows? And does this even matter?
It does matter. It does matter, because if you cut the line, if you cut the anchor entirely, then nobody's going to listen to you. You have to be you have to be towing some party line for you to make an impact on listeners and your audience. You still have to be like, oh, no, I'm part of you guys. I buy into all this. But look at this other way. And I think there's no way to really know if he believes.
Yeah. Yeah. It also makes for clever arguments. So let me read another quote. This is really interesting. So he argues that artists need freedom to do their art. So he says, artists do not demand indiscriminate freedom to do whatever they want. Artists accept being under leadership. The only question they raise is what kind of leadership it should be. It must be said that artists also want freedom, but they only demand freedom in art.
It's almost circular.
Yeah, so what he's saying here is he's saying that, look, the artists in the north of Vietnam, the communist Vietnam, they support the government, and they also support their leaders, but they need to have freedom in art, because the leaders and the political movement, the communist revolution, it needs help from artists, but it needs for the artists to be free. So the leaders of the revolution should not tell the artists what to do, even though the leaders of the revolution need the artists' help. So it's interesting, this relationship between artists and the leaders, the political leaders. So he says, literature and art serve politics, and politics must lead literature and art. However, for politics to achieve its aims, it needs the help of art. But artists need freedom. I don't know if this does this make sense even? No.
Sense, because it's circular. You're like saying, we need the freedom as artists to be able to do whatever we want, but then the people who should be controlling this, we should be able to control who those leaders are, almost. It's a very circular.
No. So he's saying that the artists accept the leadership. They don't want to control the leaders. The artists don't want to control the leaders.
Okay.
Yeah. The artists accept the leaders and their political goals, and the leaders of the political leaders need the help of the artists to promote communist revolution, for example.
It's too neat.
And then Phan Khoi says that the problem happens when the leaders start encroaching on the artistic privacy of the artists. So what he's saying is that you need to leave artists alone, and they will almost spontaneously
do the right thing.
support, yet do the right thing. So he says, quote, for the past 2 years, our artistic leaders, so the political leaders, have gone too far and failed to keep that unwritten agreement. The leaders have increasingly encroached on the artistic privacy of artists. Yeah, so there's this theory that...
It's just so much more complicated than that. I think it's too simplistic, what he's saying.
Yeah.
Just doesn't make enough sense to I don't know. Maybe it was a different time, but just to my ears today, that, you know, I think art and politics have to kind of be at odds with each other. Has to. I think the structure of a healthy society has artists speaking up against the government, and the government cannot censor the artists in a robust society like America, you know, in theoretically.
Yeah. So his faith, I would say, is that if you leave artists alone, then they will kind of automatically do the right thing, meaning they will become good socialists or communist revolutionaries. And this actually echoes some theories. For example, Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Everybody's heard of Rousseau. And Rousseau is famous for thinking that, you know, the deep down inside all of us is a good person. Deep down, really deep down, is a good person who cares more about the collective than themselves. And the thing that made us all selfish individuals is actually society, like the corrupting, like, for example, Instagram. You know, if Rousseau were alive to see Instagram, he would be like, exactly. Like, Instagram makes us all competitive with each other. We all want to appear like we're having nicer lives than others. We all have this vanity and this self-love. But deep down inside, we all, the good part of us, we all would serve society over ourselves. And I think that's what Fankoy is saying here. Now, I don't know if he actually believes it, but it is what he's saying, you know, that if you leave artists alone, the good part of them will come out and it'll be revolutionary, because that's what being good is, according to him.
You know, the exercise of talking about all these figures day in and day out with each other over the last few months has given me such compassion for the Vietnamese person's journey, especially like my own. There are so many things that I was not aware of about being Vietnamese. And the more we get into this stuff, the more we're just kind of blown away that these thoughts and thinkers were existing way before like our parents were born.
Yeah. Let me wind down the episode by saying one more thing that I think is just fascinating. So here he's talking about book banning. Oh. I mean, you and me, Ken, we're talking about how these historical figures might speak to the present. I mean, at present, the United States government has banned thousands of books. I mean, okay, part of it is the government, but also like in local state, school districts, banning children's books, banning all sorts of books from the libraries. This is what Fankoy had to say about banning books. He said, if you want to ban a book, then fine, ban it. But you should say why you're banning it. You should say why it's guilty. It's like, you know, arresting someone and putting them on trial. You need to show why they're guilty. And then he says, is it a good idea to not let anyone say anything? Maybe, but usually when people cannot say something to relieve their anger, they feel angry inside. So he's describing, like, here's what will happen if you censor people, if you ban people. And he says people actually buy banned books for more money, often double the price before the ban. And after a long time, the price of the book will get more expensive. Banning it, I'm quoting him, banning it means not wanting people to read it, but unexpectedly, it makes people read it even more. And then he says, there's no pleasure like the pleasure of closing the door tightly when it's raining and then reading forbidden books. I'm gonna say it in Vietnamese. So he says, không có cái thú gì bằng cái thú trong lúc trời mưa, đóng cửa cho chặt lại, rồi đọc sách cấm.
Love it. It's a great translation.
You know? So, and I'll end with this interesting bit. So in 1956, there was a Saigon newspaper who accused him of serving the Viet Cong. And his reply was, you guys are wrong that I follow the Viet Cong and that I serve the Viet Cong. I am a servant, but I'm a servant of the people, not a servant of the imperialists and landlords. As for the Vietnamese communists, they are just servants of the people like me. So I think those are interesting last words.
Verbal jujitsu.
Yeah.
Well, this is great. I am curious the next few figures, because we're taking a lot of big swings. You're taking a lot of big swings and taking us to a lot of interesting places. Thank you for that.
Thank you. It's a journey with unexpected discoveries.
It really is, Kevin. I think the audience is really enjoying this. Thank you once again.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.